And then she tells her story. And you watch this, you say, boy, we're just hurting this person. She's getting more and more upset. And if you would just adopt her body posture for a second, just sit like this. Just sit like this and say, it's a beautiful day in this Quaker Center. And you know, almost no therapist gets trained to realize that as long as you sit like this, you're going to feel terrible. And that in order to feel better, and this is something we have known for at least 100 years, but people don't get taught in school, that if you want to feel joyful, you have to stand like this. And if you stand like this, you cannot help but to feel joyful. And if you want to feel like shit, just sit like this, and you will feel like shit. That's completely predictable, because your body determines how you feel. But therapists don't do that in school. So you learn that later on. That's what I always like to say. We get a license to malpractice, and then slowly our patients become our teachers, and they pay us money to learn. It's a great, great field to be in. And so Steve showed me a picture, and I said, so were you showing me that Clea is a failed treatment? He says, well, let me show you what happened after two sessions of EMDR. So I wiggle my fingers in front of this person's eyes. I have her remember what she saw, what she heard. And now this is the beginning of the third treatment session. Can you turn it up? Well, you turned it down earlier, remember? Yeah. Oh, let's see how it goes. Because initially it was very loud, remember this morning? Yeah. Uh-oh. That's too bad. And here's the same woman two weeks later. And this really blows my mind. I've never in my practice seen somebody move from that into a junior Buddha. And what's also interesting when you start thinking about this is that Western art, let's say, Metropolitan Museum, the Barnes Collection here in Philadelphia, you don't have any pictures of people sitting like this. This is not the culture that we come from. We have people sitting on horses and lances and fruit and a lot of estrogen and testosterone, but nobody sits like this. And you go to Southeast Asia, and everybody sits like this. So there's a different culture. Probably less killing going on there. And then, for a moment, just assume her posture for a second, if you can. Put your neck up, put your shoulders back, show me a sternocleidomastoid muscle, which Darwin called the muscle of curiosity, and sit like this, and now think about how much you hate Dick Cheney. And it doesn't quite go. Like you sit like this, you're in a... I don't try the current guys. But you get into a different mindset of compassion, which is interesting. So it starts off like that. And then he plays me the rest of the tape. It's okay.
Yeah, I was going up to a traffic light, turned yellow, and I was still back, so I was going slow to begin with because the roads were wet. Stopped behind the white line, the light was red, traffic to my left isn't moving, wondered why. Looked up, saw a car.
So it's a totally different experience, And the moment we start doing this, we do a lot of research in this, we have this amazing outcome results, still at this point one of the best ever in a study on PTSD. I get very curious about what it is in these stupid eye movements that changes the brain. And today we now know that you change all kind of circuitry in the brain that allows you to not feel it in your body and to observe for your brain to go like, yeah, this happened to me, but it happened to me a long time ago. But we never found NIH support for this. I had to steal from other grants to put this thing together. But people always said about EMDR, what is new about it is not good, and what's good about it is not new. I said, actually, no, it's different. There's something funny about making these eye movements that move things around. And what changes things around is that the part of your brain that allows you to observe yourself over time comes online, and you can really see from a perspective. You can see yourself from a mountaintop, and you can say what this woman says, yes, it happened to me, but it happened to me a long time ago.
Speeding at me. I just knew it was going to hit me and I was going to die. I didn't. It's fading. I can almost say right now, don't even ask me anything more about the accident because I'm not interested in discussing it. Not that I want to hide it, but I'm not. It's over.
Huh? And so anybody's ever heard me speak have seen me show this tape because I always show them. I never grow tired of it because this is my first opening into realizing two things. One is that it's possible for people to say it's over. And that should be the goal of treatment, is for people to be able to say, my God, it happened to me, but today is May 2018, and it's sure beautiful to be in this Quaker retreat, and I'm no longer there. So how do you get people there is the big question. So number one is, it's possible for it to be over. It's just a question of what will work for you, and what works for you doesn't work for everybody else. And the other thing is that wiggling your fingers is weird. You know, there's no way I can say like normal people wiggle their fingers. And I think maybe things that are weird can help people. So I get myself out of this post-European alcoholic culture, which I was firmly embedded in. When people say, "Will you do Qigong?" I go, "That's weird." And you try it out. I said, "That's helpful for people." And you start doing yoga. And suddenly you find it's helpful. And you start tapping acupressure points. I go, that's interesting. That helps some people also. And you start putting needles into different parts of people's bodies. And that may also work. I said, wow, that's interesting. And there's all these different ways of getting there. The question is, what works for whom? And the second question is, how does it work? But the most important question is, what works for whom? So what we're doing right now, all our money goes into basic mechanisms, and nobody is studying what works for whom, which is not a good thing at all. So we do a lot of work on that, et cetera, et cetera, and I can show you things. But what's important to know is that EMDR is a trauma therapy. So it is something that helps you to process the memories of your trauma. So it's not when you, let's say people say, oh, I was adopted as a kid and very neglected. Will EMDR work for me? I say, no, probably not, because EMDR is to help to make that, put that memory in the past. But having been abandoned, betrayed, not seen as a kid, that is different. It's a different phenomenon. And then the next thing is, at about 15, 20 years ago, two guys come to talk to me, Michael Mithoffer and Rick Doblin, and they say, Bessel, we want to ask you a question. We're interested in studying psychedelics for PTSD. And my face lights up. I'm a child of the 60s. And I did that stuff. And it was also interesting that I have a bunch of very creative friends. I have a whole bunch of friends who have done major things in the world. And I asked my friends, so to what do you attribute your immense creativity? He said, I think my taking LSD in college probably has something to do with it, as I would say also, in that because I took something that showed me that there's other realities than the reality that you're stuck in, I got to see that the world is much bigger than what my little mind is allowing me to see. And that has been accompanying me for the rest of my life and has made me more open. I also say to them, I used to work for Jan Bastiaans in the Netherlands, who treated Holocaust survivors with LSD, and he also seemed to have pretty good results with it, although he never quite wrote that up. And I also had Timothy Leary's old office at Harvard for a while, and I know what happened to old Leary, who went berserk himself, and the whole world went at him. And I say to them, you know, it's a great idea, but you'll never succeed because I know what happened to this research in the past, and all of these drugs are classified as being illegal, and you go to jail for using them. And they say, thank you very much for your opinion. We're going to do it. And these damn guys, they did it. They got permission to study MDMA, ecstasy, Molly, for PTSD. And they do a level one study, and it works pretty well. They do a level two study. And I am now the principal investigator for a level three study of MDMA. And what made me particularly interested in this time is that in the past few years, I got to see two guys in my therapy practice who you have that sometimes, for those of you who are therapists, somebody comes to see you and you sit to yourself, why do I have to be this person's therapist? I love this person. I want to be his friend. I want to go on vacation with this person, and I don't want to have this formal, distant relationship with this person. And I have this feeling with both of them, they're just marvelous people. And they were both unwanted kids. Both of them, their mothers tried to abort them. And they clearly had an early childhood of tremendous deprivation, and they have to spend their lives proving that they are worthwhile people. And boy, have they proven that they're worthwhile people. They have done wonderful things to other people. And deep down, they still feel like shit. That feeling of nobody wants me, I'm inadequate, it's no good, persists in them. And I don't know how to move that. Actually, the last thing I want to show you, if I have time, actually is another way which can move that. And so what I hear about MDMA is it puts people in a position of deep self-compassion. And that rings a bell, because in the past few years, there's a lot of research on mindfulness. Everybody's talking about mindfulness. Huh? And mindfulness is the answer. No, mindfulness is very good, but mindfulness is only useful as long as it's accompanied by self-compassion. And if you are mindful and you don't love yourself as you get into these states, it does you no good. And what is so at the core of so many people who I treat is this continued sense of, I basically fundamentally hate myself and nothing I can do can make up for that. And so I get very intrigued about the possibility of MDMA putting people in a position of deep self-compassionate, revisiting their trauma, to see it and say, oh, this poor person who had to go through this. So I'm going to show you a little MDMA session.
Think about it now, when I got blown up myself. I see it completely different now. Thinking about it, that moment that I got blown up when it was happening, and everything was moving so slow, and my mind was just racing at the speed of light. I can really go back and visualize. I've never been able to visualize it so hard before. I can really feel what it was like, and there was this
Are you ready to take your capsule?
Sure. I just wanted to tell y'all, I had this, like, this really intense, like, feeling come over my body, and my heartbeat started beating real fast, but I didn't get, at first, like, I started feeling, like, a little afraid, but then, once I started breathing, I've never felt that before, like, I literally felt my heartbeat start to slow down and everything when I started breathing and just relax. And
it's very soft, isn't it? It's
amazing how, not quickly it went away, but just how in control I felt of making it go away. So usually I've had those feelings.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it kind of felt like when a panic attack kind of comes on.
Mm-hmm.
And my heartbeat started, and I felt my whole body flush and get really hot. And then I was just amazed how I was able to not really fight it, but kind of relax.
That's good.
I just thought y'all might want to know that.
Yeah,
see, you may have.
I just feel like I should tell y'all something. I was just really amazing. It's hard to put it in words. I feel things that would come up, and then every time they would just blow away like sand. And I even purposely tried to think of things bothersome, like, you know, like money issues or something. And this voice, this part of me, just like so wise, so intelligent, just like brought this peace over me that just said, you know, you've always been taken care of, you always will be taken care of, there's nothing to worry about. And then it just flows away like sand. And then I tried thinking about that aspect of me that's just really rageful. And also, besides that image I told y'all about of, you know, the fighting with them, I had this image of it, like, in a jail cell.
Yeah.
Like, I had that part of me locked up in jail, and it's just, you know, it's dark, but it's got, you know, bright red eyes, and just really evil. And I thought of that, and I felt, like, so, I felt like I put that person there, and I went to it and just open the door and, like, hug that person, and then the eyes just faded away, and no longer had kind of an evil look to itself, and, like, we, like, I visualized both of us just taking apart the jail cell and just, you know, like, really becoming friends. And then I visualized that image I told you about of me, like, it coming out of my hips and it stabbed me in the side and everything. And I just had a strong visualization of me, like, reaching up where the knife was in my side and taking it out. And, like, I took my hands off of its neck and didn't choke it anymore, and just, like, really embraced it. And, like, I don't know, I feel like, I don't know, part of me realized that I think that I was taking that person and keeping him locked up because I was so afraid of him, and that by putting him in that cell and keeping him locked up, that I was just making it worse for him. And I was, it really more beneficial if we kind of worked together.